Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, Tulsa writer and historian Michael Wallace returns to the program. Wallace has just published his 19th book, but this latest book is a bit different than his works of popular history, and there's a personal connection for him as well. Los Luceros, New Mexico's Morning Star, tells the story of the northern New Mexico house and estate along the high road that connects Santa Fe and Taos. Los Luceros' history contains pre-Pueblan ruins and was the site of a Spanish land grant dating back to the 16th century. Through its history, the Casa Grande and its grounds have seen many histories as a seat of power during the late Spanish colonial and Mexican rule, later as an early 20th century salon that hosted artists like Thornton Wilder, D.H. Lawrence, George O'Keefe, and other notable figures of the era, interspersed with times when the house and grounds were used as barns and stables. Today, the house and grounds are owned by the state of New Mexico as a historical and cultural treasure and a spot that tells the story of the land's complex cultural history. Michael Wallace shares that history in his new book. He joins us today. He'll also be signing the book tomorrow evening and a signing at Magic City Books beginning Thursday evening, December 20th at 7 o'clock. And he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Michael Wallace, always a pleasure to have you with us. Welcome back to Studio Tulsa.
Well, it's always my delight to be with you.
This latest book about a Spanish land grant house that's one of the last remaining hundreds of years of history. It sounds like this project about Los Luceros was a labor of love. What is Los Luceros for those that don't know this place?
Los Luceros is indeed a special place. I would even put an extra in there, extra special place, at least for me and for many others. But you're right, largely a lot of people, including a lot of New Mexicans, a lot of northern New Mexicans, a lot of people who even live in that area, in Santa Fe or Taos or Española, don't even know that Los Luceros exists. And it's existed a long time. First of all, that land, of course, has existed a long time, and I go into that whole chronology in the book. But basically, what Los Luceros is today is what remains, you know, roughly 150 acres of what was one of the largest Spanish land grants in what became New Mexico. The positioning of this land is what really makes it special, because it's just north of the highway town of Española, just north of what was called by the Spanish San Juan Pueblo, but they've retained their original name, Oque Owingue, and it's nestled on the banks of the Rio Grande, the Rio Bravo, as we call it in northern New Mexico, at the foot of this great black mesa. And it's just before you enter the gorge to go up to Taos. So it's roughly 35 miles from Taos, about 28 miles from Santa Fe. And there is a bosque, or marshy woods, right along the river, filled with these great, they look to me like old gentlemen, these huge cottonwood trees that just shimmer all autumn long. Those big cottonwoods in New Mexico are better than aspens. They're just great. And then these historic buildings that remain on that property. On the cover of our book, Los Luceros, New Mexico's Morning Star, is the Casa Grande, this great edifice that has evolved over the years. It started out as a listening post for Don Juan Onate. There are adobes in the pantry of that building that date to 1598. That's conquest. Wow. When Onate used it as a listening post to keep watch over perhaps Kiowa or Utes who came down through that country. And this is when the Spanish arrived with a cross in one hand and a sword in the other.
And they used both of them.
They used both of them.
Against the indigenous population.
Frequently. So speaking of indigenous people, there are pre-Pueblo ruins on this property. There are Pueblo people on this property. Then, of course, the Spanish. Then it became many, many centuries later part of Mexico. And then quickly, during James Polk's land grab war, the Mexican War, the gringos took New Mexico. And it became a territory for many years. It was a territory even longer than Oklahoma, of course. 1912, it became a state. So everyone's DNA is on that piece of land. Indian shamans and warriors and conquistadors and soldiers and scouts and explorers. You know, Kit Carson was there. Daniel Boone's son was there bivouacking troops during the Mexican War. All sorts of people were there, good and bad people, famous and infamous, you know, poets and priests. Then when it became under the ownership of Anglos and starting in the early 20th century, and a dowager from back east, Mary Cabot Wheelwright, owned the property and restored the sagging Casa Grande and brought the place back to life. Then her friends from her good pal Mabel Dodge Lujan, the patroness of the Taos Art Colony, folks from there would matriculate down to Los Luceros. So Thornton Wilder, who many years ago I spent 3 days with as a young writer in Santa Fe, he had stories of Los Luceros. D.H. Lawrence was there. Of course, O'Keefe was there because O'Keefe became a very close friend of Wheelwright, and a young woman who went to work for Wheelwright and was there for many years and actually inherited Los Luceros, named Maria Chabot. So what I like to say is everybody from Don Juan Anate to Muhammad Ali was on this land.
So it's just sort of steeped with history.
It's just steeped with history, and you can feel it when you're there. And I know of no other place like it. So obviously I was a good choice for the state of New Mexico to do this book.
Yeah, and so you researched the history. You had a wonderful photographer that has beautiful photographs of this property.
Gene Peach, great.
And not only just the buildings, but the natural setting of the place. It is just really in this beautiful part of northern New Mexico.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I came to know Los Luceros when my now wife, Suzanne Fitzgerald Wallace, came out to New Mexico in the 60s and into the 70s. She went to work at Los Luceros for the Collier family, who are a big part of this book, an amazing family. And Charles and Nina Collier had founded the International Institute for Iberian Colonial Art, saving colonial art, both in Mexico, Central America, and the American Southwest. And she was a translator for them and lived in the Chabot House, lived where O'Keefe used to stay and so forth. Even became acquainted with some of the more famous ghosts of Los Luceros. So going to visit Suzanne there, I just literally flipped over this land. And we always saw it, being young, idealistic folks, as a place where you could really create a renaissance. It could be a home for writers and poets and painters and musicians.
Artist colony.
Artist colony. Mm-hmm. And essentially, it did in some ways, but there were so many people who possessed that land through the centuries. And some were good to the land, some not so good. Some took care of the land, some exploited the place. It's such a rich history. But ultimately, the state of New Mexico took possession of the land. And although it was in limbo for a time, now the state not only owns the land, but they've come to learn, as I've tried to teach them, that no one can own Los Luceros. You can't own a property like this. You have to be the caretaker. You have to be the curator. Just like if you own a Frank Lloyd Wright house, if you own West Hope here in Tulsa, you have to curate West Hope, you know. You have to really curate Kane's Ballroom at different sites. That's my belief as a human geographer. And I am so delighted now that this land, Los Luceros, is being properly curated.
Yeah, and there's so many histories that you could tell in this, because you could tell about how this was probably a place that Tiwas and their predecessors came to seasonally.
They did.
For millennia.
Yeah.
And then it becomes an early seat of power, first through Spain, yeah, and then later the Mexican government.
Yeah.
For those who are not familiar with Spanish land grants, this is the way Spain colonized their holdings in the New World. And so these were enormous tracts.
Enormous. And they did indeed. And this land grant originally was hundreds of thousands of acres and went right up into the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, all the way up, for those listeners who might be familiar with the high road to Taos, all the way up through an old village up there called Las Trampas, the traps in Spanish, where there's an incredible colonial church. It encompassed so much territory. And then through the years, these land grants would be parceled off, and this family member would take his or hers, and they'd sell pieces off and so forth till they were whittled down.
And so in those days, this place was a seat of power.
It was a seat of power. It was a seat of government. It is a place of hospitality where travelers would stay there. And, you know, and looking at reading, incorporating some of the diaries of early travelers who stayed at this place, who can remember having bedding rolled out for them in the Grand Sala as they're making some arduous trip by horseback through northern New Mexico, and they talked about how wonderful it was to come to this place.
And this was in the Casa Grande, the big house.
In the big house. In that Grand Sala, that big room of the big house, there is that Steinway that John D. Rockefeller Jr. gave as a hostess gift to Mary Cabot Wheelwright when she lived there, and for one of her very early dinner parties before World War II, she brought out a bright young pianist at the time who became known more for his conducting, a young Leonard Bernstein, to provide dinner music. You know, yeah, there are all those kind of charming little stories, and then plenty of big ones too. So it's really a learning place about New Mexico.
Yeah, and it's really sort of a symbol of its varied history, I think, because once Mexicans ruled that place, it became truly a seat of power. It was one of the main regional capitals, if you will.
It was. And in fact, even judicial matters were settled there. As I want to do, I'm always trying to separate the myth from reality, and plenty of both are there. But basically what I always find, the bottom line is the truth is better than fiction.
My guest today is Michael Wallace. His latest book is titled Los Luceros, a place that's special to him. It's published by the Museum of New Mexico Press. This beautiful house that has been in ruins at times in its history and then restored, and then it's ebbed and flowed throughout this history. The Mexican Wars you were referring to earlier was pretty devastating to this house. Eventually, it fell into such disrepair that when Mary Cabot Wheelwright, who restored the house, I think there were animals in that grand hallway.
Oh yeah, there. And I can remember even after Wheelwright's grand restoration in the 1920s, after the Colliers left several owners later. And Nina Collier died. She's buried right by the chapel, which is a lovely chapel, still maintained by the Archdiocese of Santa Fe. And then a few years later, Charles Collier left. Then we went through a whole litany of owners. Some of them were just awful people that really abused the land. One Dutch company came in there and they wanted to make it into a housing subdivision. My God. And, of course, that didn't happen. But I can remember, during periodic visits through the 80s, 90s, into the 2000s, Los Luceros, and actually weeping, going into the Casa Grande and you know, finding a dead badger. at one time when the bank owned the place, the acequia, this hundreds of years old acequia, the water supply for that land, dug by Indian slaves, it broke open and flooded the big house. I mean, just awful stuff. So that's why for someone like me or for my wife, Suzanne, when we come back there now and see it restored and whole again, because the bones stayed there. It's just so gratifying.
Now, you said in your idealistic days when you visited as a young man, you said you saw it as an artist colony.
We did.
It never really was exactly that, but it was somewhat like that. It was almost like a salon.
Salon is actually a great term.
Mary Cabot Wheelwright came west from the east, so many people who came to Taos and settled. Artists and their patrons together.
And their patrons.
Came. And she was a patron. Yeah. And so she restored this house.
Yes.
And it was the host of, you know, literature and art and music's most luminous people in the 1920s and 30s.
All of the arts, music, poetry, painting, all of the visual arts, the written arts, even dance. And ultimately, it led to her building in Santa Fe that great Mary Cabot Wheelwright Museum, which is perched with those other fine museums out on what we call Museum Hill, near the old Santa Fe Trail on the edge of Santa Fe. She also became quite a student of Carl Jung, and he came out. I can just imagine some of the conversations that had to be going on, conversations that probably evolved either in great toasts or in arguments. You know, if you put certain ingredients in there, if you throw in a Carl Jung and a D.H. Lawrence, you're getting a pretty high-octane circle of people.
Now, Georgia O'Keeffe figures prominently in this era of the story.
Yeah.
Now, we think of Georgia O'Keeffe being up the road in Abiquiu.
Right.
But she actually spent quite a bit of time, at least at Los Luceros, or going back and forth.
Yeah, she was there quite a bit because, as I said, she had a friendship not only with Wheelwright. Wheelwright, who always had two O'Keeffe paintings hanging by her bed, was a collector of O'Keeffe, but also a friend. And then this young, curious woman, Maria Chabot, who worked for both women, sometimes at the same time, and became especially enamored of O'Keeffe.
And I still don't understand this relationship between Mary Cabot Wheelwright, Maria Chabot, except she had her own theories about ranching, and she was doing a job outside of the normal gender expectations in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, running a ranch, restored buildings and restored properties.
Right. And what makes her such an enigma, too, is that she had this cultural side, too. She originally met Mary Cabot Wheelwright. She went out to Los Luceros to interview her, and that friendship budded out of that, and then she met O'Keeffe. If she was your friend, she was quite intense about it. And I think that intensity she had and possessiveness came to play in that very rocky relationship that developed, especially definitely with Wheelwright, but very definitely with O'Keeffe, a little too possessive and jealous of other people and so forth. And I don't get into it that much because, first of all, I don't think it's very relevant, the person's sexuality. But, you know, there were always these rumors that these three were a threesome, if you will. And I really don't think that was the case. I think Mary Cabot Wheelwright was probably asexual women.
But what was her importance to this story that you're trying to tell about Los Luceros?
Her importance to the story is her desire to be the best caretaker Los Luceros ever had. And she did. You're right. She went out. She drove tractors. She oversaw the ranch hands. She took care of things. When she finally was forced to give this place up, many people have quote-unquote, owned Los Luceros, but then found, oh, I can't handle this place. You know, I don't have the wherewithal to handle this place. So she ended her years and lived well into her 80s in Albuquerque. But she often came back for frequent visits, and there were always sad moments for her, bittersweet.
But for many years after the salon sort of broke up and Mary Cabot Wheelwright left the property, she was sort of the tenant.
She was it.
She was sort of the tenant that ran the place for many years and kept the ranching operations going, kept the houses. And there are numerous houses. We've talked about the Grant House, but it's a whole complex of
places.
Well,
there's what we now call the Victorian House. It's an adobe with a pitch roof, but it's sort of Victorian style. That house was built at the turn of the last century. And then there were several other buildings. And then when Mary Cabot Wheelwright's kinsman came out, Frank Cabot, who was related to her with all the money in the world, and decided to resurrect Los Luceros again in the early 2000s, then eventually other buildings were built there. There are new buildings quite separate from the old buildings. There's a great community building where we just had a huge book event for this book.
Now, there's also a number of guest houses that were built over the years. You've actually stayed in one as you were writing the book, right?
I stayed in one that was built by one of the various owners. He built it with the intention of luring the Dalai Lama there to live. But the River House does exist. It's a two-story adobe with these wraparound portales. And when I was commissioned by the state to write this book, I said, my one caveat is that I must come back and live on the land again. So I went out there a couple of years ago and lived there from October through January. I was there for Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year, and I loved living there right on the Rio Grande. Every morning I would have a cup of coffee and go out on the upstairs portal, look at the river, and there would be literally numbers of golden and bald eagles dancing in the air and fishing those waters. And all this was kind of my routine. Then it wouldn't be long until these three juvenile coyotes, who I knew denned up down in that bosque, would come loping by, and they'd always stop at the bottom there and look up at me. And that's when I would warn them, "Boys, leave the lambs alone." And then they would go on, and they never bothered the lambs. And out in the fields around me there, in those dormant alfalfa fields, were all these sandhill cranes that just covered the fields. They winter there every year. It unbelievable place.
Yeah. Again, this property has had so many lives. Has the property finally found its place today?
I think so. I really do. And that's why it's so wonderful now to see the public being able to visit Los Luceros. They have wonderful people to guide you around. For some time now, photo clubs, watercolor groups, various, the Acequia Committee from the nearby village of Alcalde, they come there and have meetings. It's become a place to congregate again. Every fall, they would open it to the public to come in and harvest as many apples as you want. It's become very popular. And then there are different, of course, seasonal activities. There are people there again, and that's the essential element for this place. That's what makes that old adobe sing again, that Casa Grande, is to have people walking through that grand sala.
It sounds like this was a real labor of love for you. This is something that you spent your youth at. It was obviously a great enjoyment to actually get in and learn the roots of this property that you had such an attachment to.
It truly was.
Well, Michael, as always, pleasure to speak with you.
It's good to be with you, Rich.
Michael Wallace is the author of Los Luceros, New Mexico's Morning Star. It's published by the Museum of New Mexico Press. You'll be signing the book and speaking about the book tomorrow evening at 7 at Magic City Books. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Connie Cronley.
Over the holidays, I was a vision, an old dame on a walker hobbling into the liquor store. Oh, let me back up. In the fall, I stepped on a tiny rock, half the size of a golf ball, fell in my driveway, and broke my leg, a fractured femur. I was particular to say it wasn't a broken hip. A broken hip is something old women get. A broken leg is what a feisty old dame might get. Maybe a sports accident, mastering that kickflip move on my skateboard. Well, for a couple of weeks, I was a shut-in, stuck in my house, and watching a little squirrel, day after day, eat an entire pumpkin I'd put on the front porch for Halloween. By the time the pumpkin was gone, the little squirrel wasn't so little anymore. I'd been sent home from the hospital with a walker, and eventually I could make little outings with it. That's when I understood why so many of the old dames on walkers are cranky. I was cranky too, cranky that my leg wasn't working, cranky that the walker is awkward and gets tangled in things, cranky that the basket on the walker tends to tip it over and spill everything on the floor. And when I went out, cranky that people cut me no slack. In fact, they cut in front of me. When I went to the grocery store and rode in one of those riding carts, it was even worse. People cut me off or blocked my way or reached in front of me to grab the last item on the shelf. I saw able-bodied people park in the handicap places and laugh. None of this improved my mood. And I did not suffer this in silence. I said to them, "Really?" I said that a lot, and sometimes I upped the ante and said, "I mean it, really?" Those motorized shopping carts are not the smoothest driving vehicles, and I'd lurch to the store, running into aisles and knocking over holiday exhibits, getting crankier than ever, and leaving behind me a blue stream of profanity, most of it my own. Then again, holidays are when tempers can be short. I remember one holiday I cleaned house to a fare-thee-well and decorated it extravagantly and invited a few people over for a party. Nobody wanted to come because it was the holiday season and they were busy. Now, this really annoyed me, and it wasn't so much that I wanted to see them, but I really wanted to see them see my holiday-decorated house. Well, while I was recovering from my broken leg, I could ask people to pick up prescriptions for me and fetch me necessities, but I hesitated to ask them to get me my favorite champagne or provisions for a bracing gin and tonic. So there I was, on my walker, headed toward the liquor store door like a drone on a target. And then someone opened the door for me. A great kindness. Now I know where to find courteous people, and it's not in the vegetable aisle. The broken leg was a lesson in patience and slowing down and making an effort, especially during the holidays, not to be cranky. Maybe I'll learn this lesson. It is the season of miracles.
Connie Cronley is a writer, essayist, and a columnist for Tulsa People magazine and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. By the way, she'll be one of several readers in a series of readings from David Sedaris' Holidays on Ice, featuring Public Radio Tulsa commentators and hosts, which is coming up Sunday, December 23rd at 7 o'clock at Magic City Books. We hope to see you there. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.